From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
This week on War News Radio, Competing Narratives, I'm Leo Elliott.
And I'm Carlo Civilotti.
First, we present our satirical news segment, Filibustered.
Next, we hear updates on Boko Haram in Nigeria.
Finally, reporter Sarah Morrell reflects on her three-day program in the West Bank.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Strikes began this week in the Syrian city of Raqqa after ISIS released a video purporting to show Jordanian pilot Moaz Kasaspa burning alive. King Abdullah cut short his trip to Washington to meet with Kasaspa's family and express solidarity. He and other Jordanian leaders have pledged a proportional reaction to the killing. Jordan's immediate response includes the execution of an Iraqi prisoner and failed suicide bomber whose release ISIS demanded in exchange for the life of Japanese journalist Kenji Goto. ISIS reportedly executed Goto earlier this week.
In a related story, the United Arab Emirates has suspended airstrikes against ISIS, citing poor emergency plans for downed pilots. U.S. officials confirmed that the UAE officially withdrew from the anti-ISIS coalition in December after the capture of Jordanian pilot Moaz Kasaspa. The UAE now says they will not resume airstrikes until the U.S. relocates its search and rescue operations from Kuwait to northern Iraq, closer to the battlefield.
Cameroonian officials say Boko Haram killed at least 91 villagers and wounded more than 500 in a town on the border with Nigeria. The revenge attack comes after the African Union authorized Nigeria and neighboring states to coordinate military efforts against Boko Haram. Chad has moved 2,500 troops into Nigeria following a period of airstrikes aimed at blocking a key point in Boko Haram's supply chain. The Nigerian government announced that coalition forces have reclaimed several towns in the region. Last week, France deployed aircraft for surveillance purposes.
An Egyptian court is upholding the death sentence for 183 people accused of killing 11 police officers during protests in 2013. This is the most recent mass trial in Egypt, a practice human rights group Amnesty International condemns as unfair and inhumane. Critics of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi say he is trying to silence members of the Muslim Brotherhood and other political opponents. President Sisi maintains that the courts are independent. At least 800 protesters died during a 2013 police crackdown in Egypt.
The Obama administration is actively considering whether to provide defensive weapons to Ukrainian forces. Arms could include Humvees, anti-armor missiles, and drones. President Obama's nominee for Secretary of State, Ashton Carter, has expressed support for arming Ukraine. Members of the Senate Armed Services are also urging the White House to supply weapons. The UN reports that 224 civilians have died in 3 weeks of escalated fighting between pro-Russian rebels and Ukrainian troops. The eastern Ukrainian town of Vuliersk, known in Russia as Uglegorsk, fell under rebel control earlier this week.
A majority of Yemeni political parties have agreed to create a presidential council that will govern the country for a year. The UN-brokered deal comes after Houthi militants threatened to seize power if an agreement was not reached by Wednesday. Yemeni President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi resigned in January after Houthi rebels took over the presidential palace. Although Mansour Hadi was a close ally of the United States, American officials insist that the change in government will not affect the current campaign of drone strikes against al-Qaeda's Yemeni affiliate.
Two soldiers guarding a Jewish cultural center in Nice, France, were injured by an attacker with a knife. Regional police have arrested the man and detained a second person for questioning. The mayor of Nice, Christian Estrosi, is calling the act a deliberate assault against the military and has demanded the attacker face a heavy sentence. 10,500 French troops are currently deployed to synagogues, Jewish schools, and other sensitive venues across the country following last month's attacks in Paris.
The International Court of Justice, the UN's highest civil court, has cleared both Serbia and Croatia of genocide charges. In 1999, Croatia filed a claim of genocide against Serbia for violence during Croatia's secession from Yugoslavia, including the deaths of over 12,000 civilians. Serbia filed a counterclaim in 2010, saying the Croatian government committed genocide in its 1995 campaign to reclaim lost territory. The ICJ ruled that targeted mass violence was committed by both sides of the conflict, but neither case could prove intent to destroy a group of people. Serbian and Croatian leaders alike hailed the decision as a step towards reconciliation.
This month, Cuba and the United States are due to hold a second round of diplomatic talks in Washington. Havana has called on the U.S. to stop supporting Cuban opposition members and to remove Cuba from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. The Obama administration has refused to return the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, as demanded by Cuban President Raúl Castro. At home, some legislators want to roll back a 1966 law giving all Cubans who arrive in the U.S. political refugee status and a path to citizenship. Critics argue that the Cuban Adjustment Act is inconsistent with the move to restore diplomatic ties. This January, Cuba temporarily detained 178 political prisoners, a decrease from the average monthly figure of 741 in 2014.
Venezuela is authorizing police to use deadly force against protesters. Recent high inflation and shortages have led to long lines for food across the country. Now National Guardsmen are occupying select supermarkets to stop retail owners from hoarding scarce goods. Many economists say scarcity is the result of low oil prices and government price controls rather than hoarding. Relations between the United States and Venezuela soured this week due to concerns about human rights abuses against Venezuelan protesters. The U.S. imposed new visa restrictions on current and former Venezuelan officials. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, meanwhile, has asked a regional South American body to open diplomatic talks with the U.S. He also accuses U.S. officials of conspiring to overthrow his government.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Sarah Morrell and Jay Clayton have decided to stop trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
Darn it, Jay. I really thought the controversy over depicting the Prophet ended with that South Park episode a few years ago. Don't most Westerners get their morals that way?
That's pretty heavy stuff to start the show with, isn't it? I thought the editors told us that our listeners really wanted a more lighthearted show this month.
Well, we don't track our viewership, so who knows where they got that idea from? I mean, it's entirely possible that the only people listening to us work for the NSA.
Oh, geez, that's also kind of a downer. How about we try something like, This Week on Filibusted, what not to wear to a political and economic summit?
You mean like Narendra Modi's suit with his name embroidered all over it?
Now, Sarah, we all know how badly you want one of those suits, marking a rare occasion where we make fun of your personal habits and not mine, but there are more important things to talk about today.
Well, I'm always happy to divert the subject away from my fashion sense.
Even if we're about to talk about 8-year-olds getting questioned by the police?
What did they even get taken in for, pulling the heads off of their Barbie dolls?
8-year-old Ahmed, from Nice, was taken in for questioning along with his father for allegedly expressing support for the January 7th Charlie Hebdo attack. Child had merely made a comment to his third-grade teacher criticizing Charlie Hebdo's depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, whose physical form is not allowed to be depicted according to Islamic law.
Well, it's not as surprising as it should be, given that 54 people were arrested in France in the first week after the January 7th attack, including 4 children, for defending or glorifying terrorism.
A number of them were arrested for comments made online, through sites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
Turns out that inciting terrorism online actually carries a longer prison sentence in France than merely inciting terrorism.
I wonder how the French police would respond to Yik Yak.
It has to be more amusing than reading through 5 million Twitter accounts. They would at least get to upvote all the fun comments they like.
The sheer rate of arrests, many of which had already ended in criminal convictions within that first week, really emphasizes how governments act rashly when they're scared of terrorist attack.
Obviously, there are valid concerns about the ease of making offensive, inappropriate, and even threatening comments online. But when a threatening or offensive comment seems to criticize Charlie Hebdo's cartoons, the person gets arrested. And if you make the cartoon, you don't. There's a real inconsistency there.
I mean, are you really going to tell me that we're all terrified by what a third grader mentions to his teacher?
And the speed and intensity of these arrests and convictions can only happen because governments are building off of existing laws and structures. How are they even able to figure out what people are saying about the attacks? Not everyone has a third grade teacher standing by, ready to report them.
Brilliant setup for our inevitable explanation there, Sarah. In December 2013, the French government, with surprisingly little news coverage, passed a law that legalized many forms of internet surveillance at the hands of the French police, intelligence, and anti-terrorist agencies.
And they say that American audiences can't relate to the French.
Every attack becomes an excuse for more surveillance. Again, within a week of the January 7th attacks, the French government asked technology firms to help them ramp up internet surveillance. And the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, announced that their government is considering an even broader surveillance law.
And it's not just France. A new proposed UK anti-terror bill could require all teachers to report children who might be at risk of being drawn into terrorism. And when we say all teachers, we mean all teachers, pre-K and up.
Terrorist toddlers? Well, that sounds like a TLC reality TV show.
Honey Boo Boo is worried about being usurped.
The British government is also considering banning all encrypted communications, which more and more people are using to stop governments from reading their data. Prime Minister David Cameron compared encrypted online communication to letters and phone conversations.
Wait, I'm confused. He's saying that encrypted communications are bad because they're like other forms of communication? Literally, what is wrong with it being like a letter?
It seems likely he's responding to Apple's announcement that the new iPhone 6 can encrypt your text messages and emails, meaning that no government can acquire data directly from Apple.
Wow, I guess David Cameron never got over the BlackBerry going out of style.
We went to Apple to see if they'd pay us for that joke, but they told us we'd have to have their logo actually branded on our foreheads before they'd give us any money.
Apple didn't seem to understand that we're a radio show.
And I hope you're all sitting comfortably, because we haven't even started on all the ways the US does exactly this.
So, I know you're all expecting us to talk about Edward Snowden, or to make a snarky comment about Benedict Cumberbatch's entirely unmemorable portrayal of Julian Assange. But we thought we'd keep you on your toes a little bit.
Just last week, the American Civil Liberties Union uncovered documents that reveal a massive DEA program to track license plates across the country, allowing for easier and more continuous tracking of people's locations without their knowledge. And, of course, without regulation on who they can do this to.
In fact, the Department of Homeland Security claimed last year that they had canceled a similar program. But that program was actually much smaller than the DEA project, which started in 2008.
And the worst part of all this is that it somehow no longer feels shocking. Every few months, it seems like there's a new revelation about government access to our data and monitoring of our locations.
Even when President Obama was trumpeting cybersecurity reform during his State of the Union address, the actual details of his plan don't curtail the distribution of personal data.
For example, Obama proposed federal standards that would outline when corporations must inform the government that a consumer's data has been stolen. But these standards would replace state regulations, some of which are actually far more stringent. And his proposals provide incentives for companies to share more data with the Department of Homeland Security, which in turn can then share that data with other government agencies.
And it's not just that the US government is monitoring us. It's that there's so little clarity about what the government does and does not have the authority to do. We only find out that these programs exist after Freedom of Information Acts or even government leaks.
At some point, the dog just needs to admit that he ate the homework.
And that's the fundamental difference between American and UK or French policy. France's reactions to the January 7th attack are extreme, but they're also out in the open, where they can be debated and discussed by the general public.
But here, the NSA can successfully petition the Supreme Court to dismiss an ACLU challenge against their warrantless wiretapping by claiming that there is no such wiretapping.
The irony being that this petition that we just referenced occurred 4 months before Edward Snowden conclusively showed that warrantless wiretapping is most definitely what they were doing.
Of course, Snowden is old news by now. And that's the concerning part. At the point where you no longer care about warrantless wiretapping, do you even pause because they're tracking license plates?
As soon as our reaction becomes apathy, then we accept massive surveillance as the new normal and stop agitating for reform.
Given Obama's announcements in the State of the Union, this is the ideal time to be talking about what regulations should be put in place over the next 2 years. There's an opportunity for the creation of real guidelines. The president just has to take it.
But when we joke about how the NSA is listening to everything we say, that makes it really difficult to identify and challenge specific programs and policies.
And you know we're being legit, because we're out of a job if we can't make jokes.
At which point our salaries fall from $0 to zero-er dollars.
Here's to decades of paying off student debt. For Filibusted, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Sarah Morrell. It's been a pleasure, at least for us.
This is War News Radio. You've heard about escalating violence by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram based in Nigeria, but few have considered how religious groups can become part of a solution. War News Radio's Sabrina Merrill talks to a group trying to build interfaith dialogue between Muslims and Christians. work especially important ahead of elections later this month.
While you might no longer see hashtag BringBackOurGirls on Twitter or post about Boko Haram on Facebook, that does not mean that the message is not as pertinent now as it was in April of 2014. Boko Haram continues to wreak havoc on Nigeria. The terrorist militant and Islamist movement based in northeast Nigeria controls an area the size of Belgium. They have forced roughly 1.5 million to flee and have killed between an estimated 9,000 and 17,500 people since beginning attacks in 2009. Nigeria is evenly split between its Muslim and Christian populations, but Western media tends to focus on Boko Haram's attacks against Christians, particularly the kidnapping of 276 Christian schoolgirls. While it's important to focus on Boko Haram's impact in Nigeria, it is necessary to explore how politics, religion, and society interact. By doing this, we begin to see the potential effects interfaith dialogue can have on the country and understand the growing concern about instability in the face of Nigeria's upcoming elections.
Boko Haram has been very actively trying to situate itself as the defender of Islam in northern Nigeria, and has on occasion very actively targeted Christians in order to try to ignite the Muslim-Christian divide in order to situate itself as the defender of Islam. But in actuality, at least two-thirds of the deaths in the Boko Haram insurgency are among Muslims. And the insurgency started with a Muslim president in office in Abuja. I think in many ways the anger of Boko Haram is even more focused on other Muslims who they feel, are not living life the way it should be lived.
That was Dr. Darren Q, chair of the Department of Conflict Resolution, Human Security, and Global Governance at University of Massachusetts Boston. Q believes that Boko Haram has both attempted to target Christians and situate itself in local conflicts between Christians and Muslims. This highlights the underlying religious conflict in Nigeria between the South and the North, the Christian majority and the Muslim majority. Q and colleague Dr. Eben Weitzman, director of the Graduate Program in Conflict Resolution, Master's and Graduate Certificate, and a Swarthmore alum of the Class of 84, have been working with the Interfaith Media Center in Kaduna, Nigeria, to directly address the underlying religious conflict. According to Weitzman, the project's location is a physical manifestation of the religious divide.
And we're in each of the six sort of major northeast states where there's been a lot of violence. In each of those states, we've identified three flashpoint communities and two model communities. In each of those communities, the flashpoint communities and the model communities where the community is already dealing with religious tensions well, taking on a very ambitious program in each of those communities that consists of training community members in dialogue, engaging them in interfaith dialogue, training community members in how to conduct interfaith dialogue, trying to build relationships in those ways.
The Interfaith Mediation Center aims to create a peaceful society through nonviolent and strategic engagements in Nigeria and beyond. The center was established in 1995 by two individuals on opposite sides of the religious divide, Imam Muhammad Ashfa and Pastor James Wuye. Weitzman says that the sworn enemies, who even tried to kill each other, reconciled in the early 1990s after a mutual acquaintance urged them to sit down and simply talk. Their work developed out of their story.
They created this Interfaith Mediation Center, which does much more than mediation. They use the power of their personal narrative, in part, and the transformation they went through to bring others along and to reconsider violent opposition to one another and to forge common bonds. And they're really quite powerful. They're very charismatic. They're deeply devoted to peace and very effective. So our work right now and for the last several years has been very much focused on a partnership with them.
The partnership that Dr. Weitzman is referring to involves working on conflict resolution and democracy building, connecting the Interfaith Mediation Center, IMC, to larger networks of other conflict resolution activists who are working across Nigeria, and aiding in building an innovative early warning system. According to Dr. Q, prevention and dialogue are both main components of the partnership with the IMC.
To help them build an innovative early warning system for which we are working in collaboration with the Massachusetts Office of Public Collaboration, which has a specialty in developing early warning systems, which help IMC better gather data about conflict and peace trends in the areas that they're working, and then take this information back to the communities and have the communities analyze it and decide what sort of local action should be taken. And we're also working with another local partner in Boston, Public Conversations Project, which has a particular expertise in dialogue on issues that are intractable. And so PTP has been working with IMC to expand their dialogue capacity, and they've developed an interesting hybrid model that blends some of IMC's approaches with PTP's work.
With the continuing rise of Boko Haram in Nigeria, attacking both Muslims and Christians, the Interfaith Mediation Center plays a key role in creating interfaith dialogue at the community level.
And we're in each of the six sort of major Northeast states where there's been a lot of violence. In each of those states, we've identified three flashpoint communities and two model communities. In each of those communities, the flashpoint communities and the model communities where the community is already dealing with religious tensions well, taking on a very ambitious program in each of those communities that consists of training community members in dialogue, engaging them in interfaith dialogue, training community members in how to conduct interfaith dialogue, trying to build relationships in those ways.
Dr. Weitzman believes that in addition to working at the community level, the Interfaith Mediation Center emphasizes the importance of coexistence at a national level. Through legislative agenda and hearings, the IMC is moving to change the national culture around hate speech.
Working with leaders in those states, in those communities, particularly clergy who tend to get visibility, airtime, who tend to be on the radio and so on, working with them, encouraging them to communicate messages of tolerance and peaceful coexistence rather than engaging in hate speech and whipping up violence.
The Interfaith Mediation Center has felt the impact of Boko Haram. Boko Haram's well-known attacks have been against Western education. However, the group has also made its political goal to create an Islamic state. Borno State, a state where the IMC is supposed to be working, is currently at the heart of Boko Haram's insurgency. There, the terrorist group controls roughly 70% of the state. Baga, a town in Borno, was the site of the January 2015 massacre of an estimated 2,000 people. Even though the IMC's ability to work has been hindered, according to Dr. Q, the Early Warning Network has been able to provide updates on and alerts about the situation.
It's been increasingly difficult to work with these local partners. The cell phone lines are down because Boko Haram attacks them in order to stop those sorts of communications. And then, with the military presence in the area, also makes movement very, very difficult. So many of the members of our networks have not been able to conduct the sort of peace activities that we're able to do in other states. Nonetheless, they are still, trying to do what they can in the limited, areas of operation that they have. And they're also certainly contributing to the early warning network as well. And we're getting, at least a regular reports on what the situation is like, and trying to, alert other actors in the networks to see what they can do, whatever they can.
On a broader level, it is critical to realize the impact religion and ethnicity have on Nigerian society, particularly in politics. Over the past 20 years, the religious divide between North and South has led to a growing division in Nigerian politics. According to Dr. Weitzman, in the wake of this month's election, there has been increasing agitation and violence across religious lines.
There is a sort of a power-sharing agreement, and I'm not quite sure how formalized this has ever been made, but There's a power-sharing agreement that there should be two terms of a Christian president and two terms of a Muslim president. And the current president, Goodluck Jonathan, took power in the midst of a term when his predecessor had to step down. And so Jonathan has served a term and a half, essentially, and his supporters believe that under that situation, he should be entitled to a second full term. And the other side feels that, he's already had his two terms and should not be running again.
Dr. Darren Q agrees and feels that in some ways, the politics of the moment, the intense struggle between the opposition and the People's Democratic Party, is more important than the Boko Haram insurgency.
That struggle is happening in all 36 states of the Federation and certainly has the potential of exacerbating religious divides all across the nation. And the next month with elections in February is going to be very volatile. And so IMC and its networks are definitely scrambling to try to get as much sort of support in place so that as things continue to heat up, they can do their best to try to diffuse these tensions, at least in the neighborhoods where they're active.
A continual problem in Nigeria is the fairness of its elections. Dr. Q believes that if it was a fair and free election, then the opposition would definitely be favored, but given the political climate, that is not likely to happen. However, he notes that the opposition is planning to take a different response this time around.
However, the opposition has said that it's not going to take things to the courts. It's going to take them to the street. It may be enough to ensure an opposition victory. But I would say I'd put the chances at 50-50 at this point. But note that kind of people power action is certain to be highly unstable, could lead to violence in the streets, and could be a really difficult period. So we're all sort of holding our breath to see how things go.
While it is critical to focus on Boko Haram's horrific attacks and spreading campaign, little is being said about an underlying problem in Nigeria, the religious divide. Looking forward, Dr. Eben Weitzman brings up an interesting point. He wonders and expresses concern over whether people have diverted a sense of urgency from the interfaith problem to the Boko Haram problem. As we get closer to this month's election and votes are cast, we will see to what degree religion and politics interact to create growing violence in Nigeria in addition to Boko Haram's violent rampages. For War News Radio, I'm Sabrina Merrill.
This is War News Radio. This past winter break, reporter Sarah Morrell took part in a 3-day program in the West Bank. Extend gives college-age students the opportunity to meet with NGOs, journalists, and activists in the West Bank to explore the conflict from a different angle. Sarah considers what it means to be personally connected to a political conflict and how to make sense of disparate narratives about complex issues.
The image that will always stick out in my mind about walking through Hebron is the signs. Hebron is the only place in the West Bank where the settler community is right in the center of a large Palestinian city. You can't walk through the city without seeing large posters with a stated narrative of Hebron's history. You see them hanging all along the route that most tourists take of the city. Written by members of the Hebron settlement, they provide a specific narrative of Hebron's political history. But what really hit me about them is that they made it impossible to escape the politics of the city. I couldn't walk through the space without thinking about the conflict, a stark contrast to my 10 days spent on Birthright. The signs state that Jews only have access to 3% of the city, emphasizing the area that the settlements are a part of. In contrast, Breaking the Silence, the organization we toured with, states that Jews have access to 20% of the city. Breaking the Silence is an organization of ex-IDF soldiers who have served in the West Bank and aim to share with the Israeli public the realities of serving in this region. Their use of 20% references the amount of land in H2, the region of Hebron, accorded to Israel in the Oslo Accords. Both Breaking the Silence and a member of the Hebron settlement explained that 700 Jews and 250,000 Palestinians live in Hebron. But here it's easy to see how the same information gets used so wildly differently by two different groups. The Hebron settler emphasized how insecure the Jewish community feels in this environment, limited in access as such a small minority. Breaking the Silence emphasized the impact that such a small group had on the city, asking how many people needed to be uprooted from their homes or banned from walking on the streets for 700 people. Through this experience, I also learned how the city was thrown into disarray by the presence of settlers. H2 used to have a thriving Palestinian community, but most people left their homes as restrictions prevented where they could walk and drive and open up shop. And regulations even banned many people from leaving their homes through their own front doors. The narrators of our experiences in Hebron start their stories in two very different places. Settlers will often argue that the military occupation of Hebron and the restrictions put on Palestinians were the result of the Second Intifada. The Second Intifada was a period of increased violence in the West Bank starting in the year 2000. It led to the building of the wall between Israel and the West Bank. When sharing their perspective, Breaking the Silence says that the restrictions on Palestinians began in 1994, when Israeli physician Baruch Goldstein killed 29 Muslims who were praying in the Cave of the Patriarchs, also called the Sanctuary of Abraham. The Cave of the Patriarchs is Sarah and Abraham's burial site, which is located within Hebron city limits. My first reaction was frustration. In the United States, it's so easy to talk about the Israel-Palestine conflict in terms of the peace process. When we talk about Obama's refusal to meet with Netanyahu or the Hezbollah attacks in the Golan Heights, it isn't personal. I may have my own opinions, and trust me, I have a lot of them, but I don't worry for my life or livelihood based on the political situation. And yet, how can you ever get groups of people to come together and forge a solution when the situation on the ground is so muddled? It doesn't even matter which narrative is actually true, because both sides see each situation through a fundamentally different series of facts. After spending 3 days in the West Bank, I was surprised by how used to the frustration I became. In that short period of time, I was able to understand why people just give up and try to live their daily lives within this complicated mess. The people that I spoke with had little effect on the high politics of negotiations and peace processes. They think far more about the impact of a military occupation on their daily life and how to fight for their needs within the system. I learned that if a settler and a Palestinian throw stones at a vehicle in the West Bank, the treatment of the two incidents is vastly different. The Palestinian is tried under military law. There are limited regulations about treatment, leading to multiple incidents of children being tied up for 24 hours before they can get access to food, water, or a bathroom. Over 99% of cases in these military courts end up in a conviction, and 55% of Palestinian child detainees are imprisoned in Israel, where their parents may not have the right to travel to visit them. Furthermore, that policy is in clear violation of international law, specifically Article 76 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And the worst part? Confessions aren't always translated into Arabic for the person reading them. When speaking with NGOs reporting on these issues, my group heard multiple cases of a Palestinian being told to sign a document written in Hebrew without knowing that they were signing a confession for their conviction. But an Israeli would be tried under civil law for the exact same crime. In the last 6 years, 89% of settlers arrested for stone throwing were released without a charge. And even if they were, their rights are fundamentally different. Israeli children have the right to have a parent with them while questioned, and are given certain protections due to a civilian who has been taken in for a crime. I guess the only way I can explain it is that for me, understanding the bigger issues became less clear. I completely get why people can't find a solution. Any division of land is going to frustrate someone, and any series of policies are going to be perceived as unfair. But other issues became clearer. Some rights should never be taken away in the name of security. But there is something weird about me being able to write this piece or have the experience of spending 3 days in the West Bank. As an American, I have access to more places in the West Bank than anyone who actually lives there. The West Bank is divided into three areas, A, B, and C. Area A, comprising of around 18% of the West Bank, is civilly and militarily controlled by the Palestinian Authority, the interim self-government body in the West Bank. Israelis are not legally allowed to access Area A, emphasized by the bright red warning signs that we saw on roads leading to these areas. Palestinians living in Area A must pass through a checkpoint to enter any other area of the West Bank. Area B, comprising of 22%, is civilly controlled by the PA and militarily controlled by the Israeli Defense Force. Area C, comprising of 60%, is an area that is predominantly inaccessible to Palestinians and is wholly controlled by the Israeli government. It is also the source of many of the West Bank's natural resources. In fact, the World Bank issued a report that argued that the PA could grow the economy and cut the budget deficit by half if they had access to these resources. With all of these restrictions on mobility, it was weird to know that I could go anywhere. IDF soldiers barely gave us a second glance, and I went through at least one checkpoint without pulling out my passport. As a result, I could speak with people from many sides of the conflict one after the other. I was allowed to see the conflicting narratives in a situation where I could ask questions and form my own opinions without having to worry about the personal consequences. I got to ask people what they thought the solution was, how they think this conflict will end, and what they think of their respective governments. These are not experiences that most people living in either Israel or Palestine get the privilege of having. The conflict is too personal, and there are too many ramifications to be able to discuss it without thinking about the people, lands, and homes that are your daily life. Now, this is not to say that it can't be hard to have contrarian opinions on Israel and America. As a Jewish American who studies Arabic and political science, people often assume that I have a vast knowledge on the Israel-Palestine conflict. But because this particular issue can be so personal for so many people, I've chosen to stay silent for a very long time, avoided educating myself on a subject I find to be important because I know every source is going to have its biases. In fact, one of the primary reasons I went on a trip to Israel and the West Bank was to stop hiding from this issue and my beliefs. I hope to learn more and come to a greater understanding, not of the solution, but of why this particular political problem is so unsolvable. Because here's where I struggled with the paradox of being a Jewish American. By not educating myself on the Israel-Palestine conflict, I was avoiding an issue that the US has spent almost $126 billion on. I cannot stay silent without also letting the conversation be dominated by voices that I may not always agree with and that have a huge impact on the future of the Middle East. And yet, the sheer process of involving myself further buys into this American privilege where people a 13-hour flight away are affecting people's daily lives without understanding what that impact looks like. So, I still don't know what this means. I think this trip taught me that all sources have their perspectives and biases that need to be understood while I continue to educate myself on the conflict. There's also so much information that just isn't part of the public lexicon. Even in Israel, only about 1/14 of the population has ever served in the West Bank. In the United States, the number of people who have traveled there is extremely small. And not that many more people have taken the time to develop a nuanced opinion on military occupation. This is a situation where people should have more questions than they do answers. And I know that I've often struggled with situations where I can't just keep learning until I figure out the one true solution. During our afternoon in the Muslim Quarter in Jerusalem's Old City, me and two friends stopped into a candy shop. I chatted away with the store owner, explaining why I knew Arabic and that I was a student from America. As we paid for our candy and left, the shop owner said to me, "Marhaban bik fi Filastin," which means, "Welcome to Palestine." I was initially confused. We were solidly in Israeli territory, and the person I was speaking to was either a permanent resident or a citizen of the State of Israel. But that wasn't how he identified himself. His experience and understanding of home was so different from mine and carried with it so many layers of history, politics, and identity that I will never understand. This is a conflict I want to keep educating myself about, and I'm looking forward to the experience of growing and shaping my opinions with time. But this experience also reminded me that there's a difference between understanding the politics of a situation and understanding a person's lived experience. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Morrell.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Mayank Agarwal, Amy DiPiero, Joel Hajboutros, Allison Raybar, Naymat Carr, Joe Millman, Kyungchan Min, Dylan Okabe-Jaudat, Jerry Chin, Amber Sheth, Lily Tyson, and Tyler Welsh. This week's show was produced by Amy DiPiero. I'm Leo Elliott.
And I'm Carlos Ivalati. Until next time, thanks for listening.